I'm real happy to be here. When I was first invited to come, it was one of the reasons I wanted to come was because I found it was for intergroup. And my early experience in AA involves intergroup, and I know how important it is. And so I'm happy to be able, I hope, to have you all make a big contribution to intergroup. I know when the speaker's good, you give more. So I'm going to do my damnedest. And if you all didn't put enough in the basket before I got up here, you better put some in after, because we're going to ask you again. So I hope I'm good so you don't mind doing that. I am real happy to be here. My name is Eve Marsh, and thanks to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and the higher powers I've come to understand him, it has not been necessary for me to take a drink since January 6, 1945. Now, what that tells me is the fact that the program that got me sober, the program that was in existence in AA at the time that I got sober, is the program that we should be using today. There's no need to change it. There's no need to add a little here, take off a little there, satisfy somebody over there. I think we must remember that the program that works is the program that was written almost over 55 years ago. The program, as I said, that got me sober, that got Bill and Bob sober, and they did add as they grew into AA. And, of course, that's the wonderful thing about AA to me, and that is the fact that it is all based on our own experience. No big, high, mucky-muck sociologist sat up in an ivory tower somewhere and said, I think this will be good for those people. You know, we've always been those people. No, this program evolved out of our own experience. It evolved as a result of what was happening in those early days. I mean, some people began to stay sober, and Bill and Dr. Bob began to figure out how they come sober, to stay sober. And so the program was based on our own experience, the experience of the early members, how they stayed sober and what kept them sober. And the same thing is true of our traditions. That was something that that grew out of our own evolution. Because as AA grew, it began to have problems. Problems that Bill and Dr. Bob had no idea would come into being. They didn't know how fast we were going to grow. They didn't know how successful we were going to be. And as problems came about during our growth, problems of bigness and success and so forth, the traditions evolved out of that experience. This works, this doesn't. So now we have our traditions. And if you don't think they're important, let me tell you a story that I just love. Excuse me, I've got to have a little drink of water. If some of you saw me drinking out of a flask down here, I want to guarantee you it was neither gin nor vodka, although it looked like both. It was water. I have to have water all the time. Or I can't talk, and wouldn't that be a shame? I worked in the General Service Office of Alcoholics Anonymous for quite a few years, and that meant, of course, that I had the opportunity to see Bill every day when he came in, and we used to chat and talk and so forth. And his office was right down the hall from mine and some of the other staff. And one day, I was going down to the conference room to look at a map, probably. I was always looking at maps. I loved the rest of the world, and I loved to see where AA was going in other parts of the world. So I was heading down to the conference room and the big maps that were on the wall there. When Bill came out of his office and he was walking toward me, he had kind of a jaunty look, and he was grinning, and I said, gosh, Bill, you look like the cat that swallowed the canary. What's up? And he said, just had the most wonderful experience. He said, Ambassador so-and-so from some country, I've forgotten which one it was, just came over and spent the morning with me, the ambassador of the United Nations. The United Nations building was right by our office at that particular time. And I said, well, that's nice. He said, yes. He said, you know what that ambassador said to me? He said, you know, if the rest of the world had AA's traditions to live by, there wouldn't be any need for the United Nations. And that meant a great deal to Bill, and I think we should take that idea to heart, how important our traditions are, because they keep us together, they help us how to, you know, teach us how to relate to one another and also to the world around us. And as things go on, we're going to need more and more answers to how we relate to the world around us, because there are more and more demands on our changing. A friend of mine who takes an AA meeting into a treatment center, and don't take this as my being against treatment centers, I think we've needed them for a long time, but I think they have to also recognize our needs. Anyhow, she was telephoned to by the head of the treatment center where she would take an AA meeting every week, and this treatment center asked her if she wouldn't please have lunch with her. And so they went to have lunch, and the gist of the luncheon was that the treatment center counselor or director or whatever it was asked my AA friend, she said, you know, you really must have your people stop telling our clients that they cannot do the fourth and fifth step in 2 weeks. Well, I think I was into my third or fourth year before I really got honest with the fifth step. I don't know about you. I was very slow, I have to admit that. I was very slow about everything in AA because I was slow about me. Because I didn't know who I was. I didn't know anything about me. I didn't know. I was just so full of confusion and so full of feelings of inferiority and feelings of not being able to be of any value to anybody. And I always wanted to be somebody. And I was always full of fear and felt isolated and alone all during my growing up years, like so many of us. I just really and truly didn't know very much about myself. And it wasn't until I got into AA and got into the fourth and fifth steps that I began to know a little bit something about me. And I was one of those people, I realize now, that I was always an alcoholic. Well, I didn't realize that at first. When I first got sober, people would say to me, well, how long do you think you've been an alcoholic? And I'd say, oh, maybe a couple of years. After I'd been sober a little longer, I'd say maybe 5 years. And sober a little longer, I'd say maybe 10 years. And eventually I got honest and looked at it. And of course, I was sober from the time I took my first drink. Not because I went out and got drunk all the time, but because of what it did for me. Like it says in the promises, it let me try and do what I couldn't do for myself. And after I got into AA, AA began to do for me what I couldn't do for myself. So I was one of those people who had that magic of AA, of what alcohol would do for me from the very first drink. During my growing up years, I was the oldest of three girls. I was the biggest, and my father, God love him, he tried very hard to be a good daddy. My mother died when I was 12, and my younger sisters and I were all raised by him and a couple of grandmothers who were so different it was impossible to believe that they could all be a part of the same family. But that happens in families, and it makes it interesting, I think. It also gives us different kinds of genes from different sides. I got some genes from my father's side that I could do without. They were the ones that made me an alcoholic. But on the other hand, I'm real grateful that I'm an alcoholic, and I never thought I'd like to be able to say that. I used to hear that when I first got sober. How could anybody be grateful to be an alcoholic? And of course, I was thinking of all the hurt that I'd given my family and all the hurt that I'd been given to other people and the missed opportunities and all those things. But I realize now that if I hadn't been an alcoholic, I never would have found AA. I couldn't have been a member of AA. I wouldn't have found a program. I wouldn't have had the tools to work with that have helped me to become the kind of person, or still striving to become the kind of person, that I really always wanted to be. But I never felt that I could ever be anything. I just always felt inadequate and feelings of lack. I didn't think I'd amount to anything. And my father didn't help me very much. He tried, I know. But every time we go and visit families on friends on Sunday afternoons back in the old days, of course you understand I'm talking about the 19th century, we used to on Sundays go visit people, you know, and he would introduce us, and he would introduce my youngest sister first. She was about 6 or 7, and she was adorable, and he called her Peach. He called her Peach because she had a little peaches and cream complexion, and so he said, this is Daddy's Peach, and everybody said, oh, isn't she darling, isn't she sweet, you know, and they ooh and ah over her. And then he'd get to my next sister and say, and this is Sis, and she's the beauty of the family. And she was the beauty of the family. She was gorgeous. She went on to Vassar and made Daisy Chang one of the most beautiful in the senior class and all that stuff. And then he came to me, and I would think there was a long pause. And then he would say, and this is Daddy's big girl. And I felt big. I felt enormous. I was 5'8½". And back in those days, they didn't grow Brooke Shields. You know, I was a giantess. None of the guys were more than this, you know. And so I felt very big, and I had broad shoulders. These are pads. Oh, they're on my shoulders. Sometimes they're back here, and I wonder what they... Good. But I was tall, and I was uncomfortable, and I was all arms and nose, this big nose. And I, you know, my father would say, darling, it's handsome. And I'd say, I don't want to be handsome. That's for boys. I want to be pretty, you know, and I was never pretty. And then I had somebody who'd say to me, it's a Roman nose. And the kids in the class would say, sure, rub it all over her face. And so I wasn't very happy with me. I was very uncomfortable about me. I didn't know how to communicate with people. I was full of fear. I was sure nobody would like me. I was desperate for people to love me. I never felt that I was a part of. I always felt that I was apart from. I never felt that I belonged. And at 16, I was sent off to college. I shouldn't have gone. I was much too young. I was bright. We're all of us bright, you know. Not very intelligent, but smart. I passed all the exams, forgot everything immediately thereafter, but, you know, I got in. But I shouldn't have gone because I really and truly didn't know how to communicate. I was very young for my years. I was naive. It was during the Prohibition era. And so at 16 in 1924, I went off to Vassar College. Save you the trouble of adding, I'm 83 today. So, well, no credit to me, just God hasn't let me die yet. That's thank you, Father. Thank you. And so I went off to college feeling very much alone, and I didn't want to stay, and I begged my dad to take me home. I'd gone up to my room and met my roommate, and she was just so Greenwich, Connecticut. She was just so society, and I just knew I'd never measure up, that, oh dear, what am I going to do? I won't be able to, she won't like me, and all those things. And I went down and begged my dad to take me home. And he said, you're a big girl, you can, I knew that, but I mean, I still felt little and inadequate. And I went back up to my room to discover that my roommate had requested a transfer. Well, I went into, you know what, immediate rejection. I was absolutely desolate. I knew it. She wouldn't be able to like me. I'm not going to belong here. This is terrible, and so on and so forth. And at that point, my new roommate walked into the room. And she had long, stringy brown hair and glasses and a whole pile of books, and she looked like what we used to call a grind. And here I am, totally rejected, feeling absolutely miserable because of it. And I take one look at this new gal, and inside, internally, I draw myself up to my full height. And out of the depths of my rejection, I look at her and I say, but I deserve better than this. Now that expressed to me the kind of ambivalence that followed me the rest of my life until I got sober in AA. On the one minute thinking that I was absolutely king of the walk, everything was wonderful, and I was it. And 15 minutes, 5 minutes later, 50 seconds later, I'm nothing, I'm nobody, I'm inadequate, I'll never amount to anything, and I feel inferior. And I could never understand what that was until I got into the fourth step of the AA program and began to learn who and what I was. So anyhow, I wasn't very happy at college. I didn't drink. Everybody was drinking out of hip flasks. I understand the kids today and the peer pressure. But I was afraid of drinking. I was afraid of what it would do to me. I'd seen people doing crazy things, and I think I probably felt that I'd lose control, without realizing how important control was as far as my life was concerned. And I knew I was going to go to Europe at the end of my sophomore year, and so I thought to myself that I would wait until I got to Europe, because if I did that, then I would learn to drink the way Europeans did, a little wine with my meals, graciously, this kind of thing. And so at the end of my junior year, I joined the group of girls along with 6 or 8 chaperones, and we went aboard a ship and headed for Europe. You had to take a ship then. There weren't any airplanes. My God, I've lived a long time. No airplanes, no radio, no telephones, no. How did people live back then? Well, anyhow, when the steward began to serve 12 miles out, they asked what we wanted. I didn't know what to order, but somebody next to me said they'd have an orange blossom, so I ordered an orange blossom. And I didn't know what it was, but you know, when I drank that orange blossom, you know what happened. The magic happened. The magic. All of a sudden, my nose is cute and a little button, and I have eyes of blue, and I'm adorable. I'm 5'2". So the magic was working right off the bat. And from then on, alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself. It was my coping medicine. It came to me to be that thing which let me deal with the problems that came my way, with life itself, and most of all with myself, I realize now. I didn't realize that then. You know, when I took the first step in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was so happy to know that I was an alcoholic and not some dumb degenerate, which by that time I thought I was. I thought that my life was unmanageable because of my drinking. It took me a long time to understand that my life was unmanageable because of me. I was the problem. But that was a long time down the road. So anyhow, I started in drinking at that point, and as I said, it became my coping medicine. I didn't drink all the time. I didn't get drunk every night. Nobody looked at me and said, my goodness, there goes an alcoholic. They didn't recognize alcoholism back in those days. They would make excuses. Somebody, if I got high or tight or drunk or offensive, which I probably did, somebody was sure to say, oh, the poor thing, her mother died. Well, my mother died 10 years before, for God's sake. But they were always eager and willing to make excuses for our drinking. Thank heaven today we're beginning to spot it earlier. We're beginning to recognize it earlier so that people can understand this illness before it gets them all the way down. And we see that with the number of young people we see coming into our fellowship day after day. And I think it's wonderful. And when you think 46 years of sobriety is a lot, think of the fact that I'm 83 and that when you all have 46 years of sobriety, you'll probably be a young 60, for God's sake. So that's the way it goes. I forgot to tell you why I have to do that. I'm sure you're dying to know. I had cancer 6 years ago, and in order to get rid of the cancer, they gave me radiation therapy, which covered my entire lower face and neck and so forth. The result is the cancer is gone. I'm clean, which is the best part. But the little side effects are I have no saliva. It killed all my saliva buds, the radiation did, so I have to constantly have liquid, otherwise I can't talk. I can't smell anything anymore either, which is probably a good thing in the present world. Anyway, I stuck it out of college. I got back, and of course I got very popular and began drinking and drank, and I got caught. I got caught every time I did anything I wasn't supposed to do. My sister went on to college the following year after I left. I got kicked out because of drinking on the campus. She went to college the following year. She not only drank on campus, but she smoked, and she also went out the windows and out in the dark and back into the dormitory through the windows late at night, 2 o'clock in the morning, never got caught. Not me, I always got caught. But anyhow, my dad came up and got me, and I felt pretty awful about the whole thing. I felt remorseful and full of regret. My mother had gone to Vassar, my sister was going to go, as I said, the following year, and I just felt really guilty and terrible about it and full of shame. But I couldn't tell my dad that. Somehow we don't seem to be able to do that. Somehow we have to sort of somehow put up a big front. And that I did. I said, Dad, this place is a terrible place. It is the worst school in the East. And I said, if they hadn't kicked me out, I would have left anyway. Because it's an awful place. And I went on in this vein until we finally got out of there and I left. And I said, besides, I know what I want to do. I'm going to be in the theater. I'm going to be an actress. And he knew that because I'd talked about it since I was about 3. But, of course, I didn't have any real idea of being an actress from the point of view of learning how to conduct myself in the theater, learning how to project my voice to the last row in the balcony. We didn't have these things then. Can you hear, by the way? Okay. Neither did I want to have to take lessons in grace, which God knows I needed, so that I could walk across the stage properly holding books on my head to get the props. I didn't really want to go through all that work. You know what I wanted. I wanted to be a star. With my name in lights, so that everybody come running up to me and saying, oh, my God, you were wonderful. And you know, it wasn't until I got into AA, until I saw what that sickness was. That was that terrible need to be approved of. That was my feeling that if you told me I was wonderful, then maybe I could begin to think so myself. Because I didn't. And I think so many of us feel that way. So many of us. I've never yet 12-stepped anybody who said their goal in life was to be the second best stenographer in the office, to be the second best teacher in the school, to be the second best swimmer on the team. You know, we all of us are striving for that perfection. We're all of us trying to be the best. Now, to try and be the best that we can be is quite different. And I think that's one of the things we learn when we come to AA, to try with this program to become the best that we can be. Because most of us, I think, had ideals and hopes and desires. I don't think any of us started out life by saying, I know what I want to be when I grow up. I want to be an alcoholic, you know. I certainly didn't. I was full of ambition. I was full of goals in life. I desperately wanted to be somebody. Now, there's the problem. We are somebody. And that's one thing we don't seem to recognize about ourselves. And when I'm working with new girls, that's one of the first things I tell them. You are somebody, even if you're nobody. Because there's a divinity within the shapes our ends. We are divine. We are made in the image and likeness. And there's this wonderful core of divinity within. There is this wonderful core of being that we have to find the best of and start developing that. And we learn that in AA once we get sober. But, of course, I didn't know any of that then. I went on to be an actress. a pretty good one, but alcohol was already a part of my life. And alcohol became a problem for me working in the theater. I was drunk on stage a couple of times. And that does not go well. Believe me, that does not go well. But I had a wonderful opportunity to tour across this country back in 1930, 31, 32, visited a lot of places in the West and saw the United States, which was really very exciting. And it was a thrilling experience, and I'm grateful that I had it, but I lost it up. My uncle, who was the manager, actor, star of the company, was very nice. At the end of 6 or 8 years, I've forgotten exactly, it's so long ago, he said to me one day, he said, "My dear darling, I'm terribly sorry, we don't have parts big enough for you next year." And that satisfied me, you know. Oh, I forgot to mention the fact that I'd already started doing something else that we alcoholics are prone to do. I started getting married. And I married a young actor in the company, and we had a little boy, and he's wonderful. The marriage didn't work very well, and already I was having problems. Every once in a while, I'd remember something my grandmother had said to me. I didn't like to remember it, but every now and then it would cross my mind. Because when I started smoking, she was very much upset. And she used to drum her fingers on the Mission rocker. That was a kind of furniture back in the old days. And she used to drum her fingers along this and make her points. And she'd say, you know, smoking leads to drinking. And drinking leads to prostitution. I never got paid. My marriage broke up, of course, after a couple of years. So there I was at the end of my marvelous theatrical career. But my son farmed out with a couple that I was paying to take care of him, living in my father's apartment, out of a job, alcoholic without knowing it, but full of fear of what my life was going to be. I was terrified because I didn't know where I belonged. I'd never felt that I belonged anywhere, but now that I'd lost the theater as a career and I'd gone out on tour producing amateur shows and I'd lost that up because I got drunk and burned up the poor woman's bed in one place, it was a good thing I didn't burn up myself as it happened. Maybe it wasn't a good thing. Yes, it was a good thing I didn't burn up myself. It was a very good thing. But anyhow, at that point my sister was living with my father and I was just sort of there because they didn't know what to do with me. And she came home one night and said, "I've got a date with a terrific guy, but I'm late. I've got to change my clothes. Will you please entertain him for a few minutes until I get ready?" And I said, "Sure." So he came. So I said to him, "Would you like a drink?" "Why, yeah, I would," he said. I said, "Well, I don't know what my father has here in the way of mixes, but I've got some bourbon. You can have it straight." "Well," he said, "is there any other way to drink it?" And I looked at him again, you know. So I gave him a couple of drinks. And he went off with my sister, and she came home about 3 hours later and said, "What did you do to Roger?" And I said, "What are you talking about?" She said, "He didn't do anything but talk about you all night." And she said, "I gave him your phone number. He's going to call you." So he called me, and we began to go together. And it was wonderful. It was, you know, instant love with bottle and bed, and you know, it was just great. I thought it was wonderful, and we fell in love, and we decided we were going to get married, and I thought it would be terrific to do. We had everything going for us. We really were loved each other, and he was a sort of an artistic kind of a fellow, and that's the kind of person I liked. I didn't like businessmen very much. I liked people who couldn't sell their paintings or couldn't get their voices in training, and they couldn't act on the stage. You know, I liked all that kind of bohemian stuff. And so he was an out-of-work radio announcer, so what could be better? So I thought, well, that was pretty good. And I was an out-of-work actress, and so we got married, and I thought it was going to be wonderful, but I didn't know that we both had a problem. We were both alcoholics, and neither one of us knew anything about alcoholism. Nobody knew much about alcoholism. You knew who the town drunk was back in those days. But there wasn't much talk about alcoholism. People drank too much, or they had a problem. Or you lied about it and you covered it up, but nobody really spotted it. My father, of course, thought he drank too much, and his family thought I drank too much, but neither one of us then could put the actual tag on. And so we got married, and it was wonderful. We had two, I thought it was going to be marvelous, but it began to have problems fairly soon. We had two beautiful little girls. My son from my former marriage came to live with us, and I thought that would be wonderful, and it was, except for my alcoholism and Roger's. And things didn't pan out as well as they should have. It was very, very difficult. I know it was hard for the children. Oh, God, I certainly do know that. And things just didn't seem to work out so well. We began to have fights, you know, every now and then. Of course, it was always his fault, you understand. I never could accept the fact that it was anything but his fault. And every now and then I'd get a black eye, and I can remember one morning I had woke up and I had two of them. And I remember I very gently leaned over and gave him a shove in the bed and said, "Look what you did to me last night." And he said, "What did you do to deserve it?" And I said, "I deserve it. I, this martyr, this wonderful human being that puts up with living with you, what do you mean, what did I deserve it?" Well, you know, I've had to come to recognize the fact that I am responsible for what happens to me. And it was a hard lesson to learn, but interestingly enough, I lived with Roger for 6 years after I got sober, and he drank every night and got drunk most of the time. And during those 6 years, I never had a black eye, which tells me something. I know I had a dirty, rotten Irish tongue. I was also pretty free with my fists. So you can see that I brought on the black eyes on myself. And it took me a little while of sobriety to come to recognize that fact. But things went along. I read the Jack Alexander article in 1941, and I remember saying to myself how wonderful that would be for Roger. And I asked him to read it. He didn't want any part of it, you know. It was called Freed Slaves of Drink. That was its subtitle. I think that was its title. We always now today call it the Jack Alexander article. But it was called Freed Slaves of Drink. And, of course, I was terribly sophisticated, you know, terribly sophisticated. And I just thought that was so corny. I thought, how corny can you get, freed slaves of drink? I had no idea what freedom was. I was a cigarette addict as well as being an alcohol addict. I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes every day. And I couldn't have stopped if you'd asked me to. And, of course, I wasn't about to stop at that point. Thank heavens I've been now stopped about 30 years. But at that time, I couldn't stop. And, of course, I didn't think I had a drinking problem. I thought he did. But he didn't, so we had to go on. I had to go on with the drinking. And the little girls, you know, they were so hurt by it. My son also was terribly hurt by it. And it got very bad. I began to feel terribly guilty. I began to feel ashamed of the way. It wasn't so much what I did to my children as it was the sins of omission. And I think sometimes for mothers, that's the worst part to deal with, the things we didn't do, the things we forgot to do, the things we neglected to do, the neglect of the children. Now, they're not getting the proper attention, loving attention, even physical attention. And so I began to feel such terrible guilt and terrible shame. And I remember one morning, my older little girl, she was Ruthie, she was about 4, I guess, and she was going to nursery school. And one morning, I had such a terrible hangover, I said, "Ruthie, dear, do you mind terribly going downstairs and waiting for the bus by yourself?" We lived in an apartment house in New York on Riverside Drive, and the lobby downstairs. I didn't want to go down there. I wanted this little girl to go down there all alone. And she looked at me and said, "Oh, Mommy, do I have to?" And so, of course, I said, "No, no, no." So I had a quick shot of whiskey, and I went down with her. I remember I had a little house coat, a dark blue seersucker with red roses all over it, and I swear it probably hadn't been washed in so long it could have carried me down there by itself. But anyhow, I went down with dark glasses on, of course, in the early morning hours in the inside lobby of a building. We all do that. And I went down there with her and got her on the bus. And as I was down there, standing there waiting for the bus, and people were going by saying, "Good morning," and I was trying to blow my voice, my breath the other direction. And I began thinking to myself, whatever happened to that girl? Whatever happened to that girl for whom there were so many goals and so many desires and so much life expectancy? What happened? I really wanted to achieve something. I really wanted to be somebody. And I really realized for the first time that alcohol had become more important than some of those things. I had sort of forgotten my integrity because alcohol had gotten so important. And it kind of frightened me, and I went back upstairs after Ruth had gone, and I began thinking again about the fact that I should go on the water wagon. And I kept going on the water wagon. I'd stay on for a month or so, and then I'd be off. And I was getting to the point where I was having these long drunks, 3 weeks, but I couldn't get. And I kept praying that I could stop before that terrible day would come. Because that terrible day would be the day that nothing would stay down, where I would hang over the toilet bowl, I'm sure you're familiar. And that I would only have been able to go to bed to be able to snap out of it. But I couldn't go to bed. I had 3 children, no help. It was toward the end of the war years, and everything was short. There was nothing to do. We were terribly poor. Of course, both of us drinking. We were obviously poor. He was working as a remittance man for his family for some untold money, like $25 a week or something, and I was just a housewife. You know what that means, working hard. And so I began to be terribly conscious of the fact that my drinking was going beyond what I wanted it to do, and I didn't know how to do anything about it. I remember looking up in the phone book once to see if there was a place where you could be treated for alcohol, and I saw Towns Hospital, and it was right near where we lived, and I thought, gee, I should find out what that is, and I called them up. I hate to tell you what the price was. Let that out, because we were penniless. Anyhow, about that time, my son began to stay out a lot in the evenings. I remember speaking to him one night, and I said, Don, why is it that you stay out every night? Why don't you stay home? And he said, Mug, I just can't stand to stay home and watch you get drunk every night. And his brown eyes they weren't angry, but they were hurt. I didn't have much love in them, I didn't think. And they upset me. And I began to think to myself, my God, you know, this is getting to be bad. But I was terrified of trying to do anything on my own. I couldn't have gone any place alone. And about that time, my mother-in-law came to visit, and she didn't stay because we were both of us drunk. And so she left a little note on the refrigerator, and I've never forgotten it. It said, my dear children, the world frowns upon inebriates. Inebriates? Inebriates? Any of you who don't like the word alcoholic, try inebriate. And then I remember this, every time I went out to Madison, New Jersey to visit her and the family out in New Jersey, she would take me over to this south window and say, daughter, do you see that house down there? And I say, yes. She'd say, a dipsomaniac lady lives in there. A dipsomaniac. I thought, why is she telling me this? Well, I began to realize that she had a message. Anyhow, in that little note she said, however, I've written to the Alcoholic Foundation, which was the forerunner of the General Service Office as we know it today, and asked them to send you some literature. And so the literature came, and it was a pamphlet. And in that pamphlet was a story of a woman, just one woman, and I read that. And for the first time, I realized that there was one other person, maybe, out there who felt the way I did. It was the feelings that had me down, all those feelings of anger and rage at the world and at my situation and at poverty, because that we had, and self-pity and those feelings that I had. And those are the feelings that drive us crazy, and those are the feelings we have to learn to deal with when we come into AA. I've always said this is a feelings illness, and I think it's a feelings recovery, because that's what we deal with. And so much of what we have to change is attitudes which involve feelings. But I didn't know that at the time. I read that article and I thought, my God, this is for me. And I begged Roger to go to AA with me, but he didn't want any part of it. And so I told my son, I said, for the first time, darling, I know I'm an alcoholic, but I promise you I will never drink again. And I meant it with all my heart, but I'd broken a lot of promises to him. And so I said again, I backed that up by the fact that if I cannot keep myself sober, I will go to AA. So I took the children away for the summer up to the country. We had a funny old house, farmhouse, with an outdoor privy and all that. We were so poor we couldn't afford anything except booze. And when I started drinking up there, and I couldn't stop, and I came back to New York to put the girls and the children in school, and I couldn't stop. I tried desperately, and finally in October, in the fall of 44, I called AA, and they told me to come on down. They gave me the address, 324 and a half, West 24th Street. And so I went down there, full of fear, terrified. I was so afraid of people, so I said. And I was, but of course I was only afraid of what you'd think of me. I didn't learn that until I began working on the fourth step. I wasn't afraid you were going to hit me or anything like that. It was just, what were you going to think of me? Well, you wouldn't approve of me. You wouldn't like me. You wouldn't love me. You wouldn't think I was wonderful. You wouldn't like my dress, my hair, whatever. You know, all that silly crap. That isn't a very nice word. But anyway, it was stupid. But I didn't realize that then, and I was full of fear to go down there and see strange people. Alcoholics, I wonder what they look like, you know. And 324, I could have looked in the mirror if I'd only known. But anyhow, 324 and a half street was the clubhouse. I nobody ever found out where the other half was, but there was a long hallway. Not quite as long as this, but about as long as that gal in the blue dress right there, and it was dark. And there was a room at the end of the hall. It was full of light, and I could hear laughter. And I was frightened, and I was terrified to go in. But I finally did. I walked down that hall into that room full of laughter and light and found love and life itself, because that was the AA meeting room. That was the clubhouse. Bill had lived upstairs with Lois at one point when they didn't have any other place to live, because he was spending all his time trying to help AA. And I went in, and I talked to this very nice man, and he told me his story. And my God, as he began to talk along, a little of my guilt began to fall away, because he'd done things even worse than I'd done. And I think that's the wonderful thing about that sharing at the very beginning. Oh, it isn't quite so terrible, that burden of guilt that you're bearing. And suddenly you realize that you're not the only person that's done these things or felt this way. And so often these things we've done have been a part of our alcoholism. We haven't realized. I've always said, don't confuse what you did with what you are. Because what we did was the illness, and what we are is that inner core of beauty, that wonderful thing that we can develop. And of course, if we go on doing those things after we're sober, then we better start doing something to change. But anyhow, he went along talking, and I told him a little bit about me, and there was another group of people over at another table, and I thought, oh, this is wonderful. I knew right away this was something that I was going to love. It was going to be wonderful for me. And so I started to leave, and I turned back, and I said, you know, I said, you've been so nice to me. I'm sorry, but there's something else I've simply got to tell you. And I sounded so serious, and I'm sure he thought I was going to tell him I'd murdered somebody. But I looked at him, and I said, I have an inferiority complex. Well, he did just what you did, you know. He laughed and he yelled over this other table, she has an inferiority complex. But of course, you know me, I thought, son of a bitch, I'm going to get out of here. He grabbed my hand, and I realized, thank God, that they were laughing out of love. They were laughing with me, not at me. And so I stayed. I got drunk over Christmas. I couldn't deal with anger. I found my husband beating up my son, and I couldn't deal with the anger that entailed. Rage is a better word. And I thought I'd pour myself a drink. As I said, I'll show him. And it took me about 4 weeks to get back, and that's why January 6, 45 is my anniversary day. And so then I went on trying to get into this program. I was terribly slow. I couldn't receive what you were trying to give me. I had such a wall around me that it was very hard for me to let it down. I was so afraid that nobody was going to like me. I would sit in the back row sometimes and weep because nobody was paying attention to me. I didn't know. I couldn't go up and say my name is Eve and I'm you. I was so wrapped up in myself. I was so shy. You know, I used to think that shy was kind of a nice way to be, you know, sort of sweet and vulnerable. It was okay, you know. Unfortunately, I heard a gal speak not too long ago who said she told her sponsor she was shy, and her sponsor said, well, out here we call that total self-obsession. So I'm afraid I have to tell you I was totally self-obsessed. As a matter of fact, I found out that I was, because I found out that the third step prayer was such a wonderful one when it said, relieve me of the bondage of self. Because that is what was bonding. That was my bondage, that bondage of self. And I've always loved that story that Harry Emerson Fosdick is purported to have said, that for the alcoholic, it's a little bit like living in a room totally surrounded by mirrors, that everything is reflected back on self. But once you get sober, suddenly the mirrors are no longer reflecting, but they're out in their windows, and you can see out and begin to relate to the rest of the world. And that's what happened to me. I was able, through AA, to begin to look out and relate to the rest of the world. So it took a long time. As I said, I was very, very slow. And sometimes I would learn things by osmosis. Sometimes I would learn things by the way other people said, what other people would say to me. And sometimes there were difficult lessons. I can remember one day I was down at the old club. We'd moved up to another club, 41st Street. And I was complaining again about Roger. I said, Roger's drinking again. I don't know what to do, and so on and so forth. And this very nice gal who would sort of taken me under her wing a little bit, wasn't really a sponsor, but she was very kind to me, and that I appreciated. She was English, and she said, darling, have you ever stopped to think what you'd do if Roger stopped drinking? And I looked at her and said, she was crazy. Why, it'd be wonderful if you stopped drinking, Amy. She said, well, just think, dear. If you stopped drinking, you wouldn't have anything to go on bitching about. Well, you know, I had to stop and think, you know. And for a long time, I realized that I was being held back by my own attitude and the fact that I kept taking Roger's inventory instead of taking my own. It was so simple and easy to do, to take his. He was a bastard, you know. The sad thing was, I really thought so. But slowly I began to latch on to the program. And very slowly I began to see that I needed to do something about me. I thought just the slogans were all I could handle at the time, and I began very slowly to work on the steps. And some wonderful things happened along the way, which kind of motivated me and helped me to get along. I never had any problem knowing I was an alcoholic. I was so damn grateful to know that I had a semi-respectable disease, that I wasn't a degenerate, that I wasn't morally awful, that I wasn't insane. I was real proud to be an AA. I thought it was the best thing that had ever happened to me. I fell in love with this fellowship the day I walked in, and I've never lost it, because I think it's the most wonderful thing that could ever happen to me. It has been the most wonderful thing that could ever happen to me. I couldn't do much in the way of sponsoring because I had children at home, but eventually when the last little one went off to nursery school as well, a couple of days a week, I could volunteer at the intergroup office. And that was the first time I began to be aware of what the service structure was all about, what little bit of service was all about. And I remembered hearing them talking at the club about the need to have an intergroup office, because people would telephone the club and somebody would call down the stairs and say, there's a gal here up on 41st Street, needs help, anybody ready to go? Can't go, I'm playing poker, can't go, I'm playing bridge, can't go, I'm doing this, can't go, I'm busy, and so on and so forth. And it became evident to Bill, who was a very wise man, who could see the need, or rather could see the answer to a need before most of us were even aware of the need. And he felt that there had to be some focal point of inquiry where people could call up and get answers that they needed about what AA was and how to get help and about alcoholism. And so the intergroup's office was started, and I was able to go as a volunteer one day a week when my youngest little girl was off at nursery school. And it was a wonderful feeling. It was a wonderful experience. It was good for me because I found out there how little I really knew. Because I had to be able to help explain AA to new people that came in. And I couldn't very well explain it when I didn't understand it myself. When I wasn't really working the program the way I should. When I hadn't really taken all the steps. And I really began at that point to get into the fourth and fifth steps. And it was a wonderful experience for me. And I was very fortunate a little bit later on. After 6 years, Roger and I decided to separate. Or rather, I decided that I couldn't go on living with him any longer. The girls were getting terribly upset. My son was away at college by that time, which was one good thing, but because they didn't always get along too well. But I knew I had to leave him because I couldn't handle the situation any longer. There wasn't any Al-Anon then, and I was working as a volunteer, and at that point, the president of Intergroup told me that the gal who was a paid secretary was leaving, and they would like to offer me the job. And he said, they've been paying her $50 a week, but we're kind of broke, so if you don't mind, we'll just pay you $200 a month. It took me a little time to realize that they were chipping me out of $25, but I was so thrilled to have a job. But he said to me, he said, I think it's a good idea if we check with Roger and see if it's okay with him if you take this job. Well, that irritated me no end, but he said, I don't want any problems down the line. I said, okay. And so he did. He asked Roger, and Roger said, sure, you know. And so I started to work at the intergroup offices as the paid staff person, and it was a terribly exciting thing to see how the traditions worked in holding groups together, the importance of those traditions, the importance of anonymity, the importance of public relations, the importance of setting up relationships with hospitals so that people could get the proper care and so on and so forth. And it was terrific. And it was after several months of that that Roger and I broke up. And I have to laugh when I think of it, because all Roger could say was, I knew damn well I shouldn't give her permission to go to that damn job, as if that would have made any difference. But men are funny. Oh, well, you know that. So meanwhile, my little girls are growing up. And with Roger gone, it was wonderful from the point of view of the fact that we could have AA in our home. Because up until then, he said, I won't have any drunks in my house. You can go to one meeting a week, and so on and so forth. So I was very restricted in the AA participation that I was allowed in order to keep peace in the family and so forth. But now that he was gone, I had AAs come to the house, and there was a lot of AA visiting back and forth, coffee and poker games on Saturday night and things of that kind. And my girls really and truly began to have that wonderful feeling of what AA is all about. And I remember one day my older daughter came running home. She was all full of excitement. She said, oh, Mommy, I know what I want to be when I grow up. And I said, what? She said, I want to be a ballet dancer and a member of AA. And, of course, I knew what she meant. She felt that fellowship, that love, that wonderful sharing, that communicating that we feel within this fellowship. And she sensed that in our home. And so she wanted that. That's what she wanted. She didn't want the degradation. She didn't want the despair. She didn't want the pain. But she got the whole package. But she's got 13 years now of AA sobriety. And I'm so grateful for that. Sadly, my son was away during that time, so he never got the benefits and the sense and the feeling about AA. So he never really understood the program. And although we have a very friendly relationship, it is not close. But I'm trying to be grateful. I've tried to make amends. But, you know, if somebody won't receive them, there's not much you can do about it. You can't hit them over the head and say, damn it, I'm trying to make amends. Shut up and listen to me. You know, I mean, if they just think, that was in the past, just forget it. You have to accept that. And so I do, and I'm grateful for the relationship that we do have. And I just was down in Dallas, and I visited him and his wife in their beautiful new home. And my grandson and my two little great-grandsons, age five and two. And so I'm grateful for that. My youngest little girl, I think, was born to be an Al-Anon. There was something about her, quite instinctive from the very beginning, I think, toward that. I can remember one day that I was getting ready to go off on a trip to speak someplace. By this time, I'm up at General Service Office, and I had to go off on a conference or something. I hadn't gone very often. I was very frightened of it and wanted to do the things right and look well. And, the ego still does problem. Does give me problems sometimes. But anyway, I was trying on hats, and I said to her, you know, she was sort of hanging over the dressing table with her hands on her hips and watching me get ready to go. And I said, I can't decide whether I should take this big garden hat, great big floppy hat, I said, because they're so becoming to me, or whether I should take this little one because it's okay and I could pack it. And I went on about this, and she finally put her hands on her skinny little hips and said, Mommy, I thought the important thing was what you said, not what you wore. So you see what I mean. Anyhow, I went on. It was General Service, and had that wonderful opportunity to work at the heartbeat of Alcoholics Anonymous, a wonderful experience, one I will always treasure in my heart and always be grateful for. And I learned so much about service. I learned about the importance of intergroups. I learned about the importance of our traditions. I learned about the importance of the conference and the concepts. And I was so glad to hear you read the concepts tonight, because so often they're not even mentioned. But meanwhile, I'm trying very hard to grow in my personal life to have that kind of development of me that I was looking for. And I had to come to realize that the one thing really we have to change is our attitudes. That's really all we can change, is our attitude and the way we react to things and the way we feel about things. And the 12 steps are a wonderful guide toward making those changes, the willingness to be removed of our character defects and to get rid of our shortcomings, that willingness to change the way in which we feel and react, in other words, our attitudes. I mean, for example, I'm very tall. Of course, God's done a little bit toward changing that. I've shrunk a little the last few years. But, you know, I really and truly, I'm very grateful that I was tall, because my Ruthie's only about 5'2", and she'd come and visit me sometimes, and she'd say, Mommy, where's the ladder? I want to get something off the top shelf. And I said, wait a minute, dear, here it is. And up goes the long arm, and down comes the package, and we're all set. I can see parades, you know. So I'm glad I'm tall. It's a change of attitude. And this great, huge nose of mine that I was so worried about all these years, I kept saying, if I only had enough money, I'd have a nose job. If I have enough money, I'm going to get a nose job. Well, I never had the money and never got the nose job. And it's a good thing now. It holds my glasses up. So that also is a change of attitude. But, of course, the big changes in attitude are the changes in reference to people. In reference to people. Learning to love people and learning, first of all, that I had to love myself. And I found the fourth step a wonderful, wonderful way of that. And I'd like to share with you the way I did it, because to me it's very helpful to girls, women who come into this program, when we're always so full of guilt and so full of shame and so hard to forgive ourselves. And I was trying to do the fourth step. I had a big yellow pad, and I couldn't find anything good to write down. And I was sitting in the old clubhouse down there before we moved out of it on 41st Street, and Marty happened to be sitting beside me. And I said, you know, I can't find anything good about myself. I can only find bad things. And she said, I don't want you to pay any attention to the bad things right now. She said, I want you to think of something good about you, all the good things you can think of about yourself, and write them down. And I said, but I don't know. She said, you'll find them. You've got to do that. She said, then, when you have found something that you know is good, work on making that better. And you'll find that these other things will get in the way. And when they do, you have to get rid of them. So I thought, well, mother love, I adore my children, I still do. And I thought, that's a good quality. And so I began to try and be the kind of a mother I'd always wanted to be. And then I began to see where anger, where impatience, where resentment, where self-pity would interfere with this process of being the kind of mother I wanted to be. And so I began to recognize my need to get rid of those, to get rid of those feelings, to stamp them down, to wipe them out, to let them go, and to learn to love myself for the person that was inside of me that I wanted to let out and had never known how to do it. And so I slowly did begin to grow in AA. I had a lot of trouble with the third step. I didn't know what God was, and I didn't realize I could make a decision until I knew what God was. And of course, that's not true. But I demonstrated to myself, they said, you must pray. And they said, the easiest prayer is thanks at night. And so I would try that, but it didn't have much meaning to me, but I was staying sober. And I knew that AA was the answer for me. I knew that here was the answer to my problem, that I could stay sober if I would just stay close and listen and try and do what was suggested. And when they said pray, I didn't know how. And then one day I had to go down to Wall Street in New York, and that meant taking a long subway ride. And I was terrified of the subways. I was so claustrophobic. But I knew I had to go. And so I got in the subway that morning, and I remember I was hanging on a strap. I got on at 96th Street and had to go all the way down to Wall Street. And I'm hanging onto the strap. The subway train is crowded. My head is pounding. My heart is palpitating. There's sweat all over my hands. I was in a panic anxiety attack that kind of hit me. And I thought, I've got to get off at the next station. I can't do this. And I remember somebody saying, try prayer. And I didn't know how to pray, but I remember the 11th step. And so I started in saying, sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. And do you know that at those moments, during those moments, my heart stopped palpitating, the sweat left my hand, my head stopped bursting, and I got all the way down to Wall Street and all the way back, okay, without any panic. And I demonstrated to myself that prayer works. Because I realized that was a kind of prayer. And then I looked back and realized how many times in my life God had been with me. How many times had been a power greater than myself looking after me. I remember the time when I sat on the ledge of a casement window on the fifth floor with my feet dangling out, hanging onto this one little casement window, screaming at my husband, who was about to walk out on me, screaming at him from the fifth floor up, saying, if you leave me, I'm going to jump. And the next morning, my dear, wonderful black lady who looked after my kids came in and said, you know, there's only one screw holding this casement window. And I realized that I had been saved. But I didn't remember that until years later. These things that we block out, these things that we forget. And sometimes we forget things about our amends, which in a way is fortunate, because I don't always feel able to cope with some of these things right off the bat. Now, I remember when I was sober about 10 years, I think, my daughter came home. She was having some problems. And she had been to a counselor or a psychiatrist, I've forgotten, psychologist, I guess. And she said, you know, Mommy, he thinks that maybe it would help if I could identify what age I was when certain things happened. Would you help me? And I said, of course, you know, playing the wonderful mother. So she said, well, Mother, how old was I that night? You hit Daddy over the head with the frying pan, and he knocked you down and broke your nose, and the cops came. But I was devastated. I was devastated. I had no idea she remembered that. She was only 2 when that happened. And here she remembered it. And then a little later on, after I was sober quite a long time, I suddenly had this flash of memory when my son was 2. And I was still trying to be an actress in the theater. And he had come back to live with me. And I lived on Gramercy Park in New York, which is a private park, but anybody who lives on the park has a key to the park, so I could put him in there. And I had an appointment with an agent. I was looking for a job. And so I put him in the park, and I said, honey, Mommy, be home as soon as you can. So just stay here like a good boy, and I'll come back in about an hour. And that was about 10 o'clock in the morning when I got back. It was almost dark. It was about 5 o'clock. And that little boy had been there all day. And you know, for the longest time, I couldn't remember that without almost weeping inside. Still do. And thank God I didn't remember it till I had enough sobriety to stand it. Because if I remembered that early on, I probably would never have been able to forgive myself. I've never discussed with him whether he remembers that or not, because he won't talk about it. So I just have to love him. And I think that's the best way to make amends. I used to do things like buying beautiful little velvet dresses that we couldn't afford and bring them home and put them on little girls and say, see what a good mummy I am, but that's not it. I think the best way we can make amends is the way in which we love and treat those that are close to us that we care about for the rest of our lives. Love is the key. Love is the most important thing. And I think it's the reason that AA has spread the way it has spread. Because the world desperately is looking for love and doesn't know how to deal with it. Doesn't know how to share. Doesn't know how to get out of themselves. Doesn't know how to get rid of anger. all these countries fighting with each other, all angry. You know, if they could just learn to love. I sometimes think back to what that ambassador said to Bill about our traditions, if people had these traditions to live by. And so AA has been absolutely fantastic as far as I'm concerned. It's done everything for me. It's made my life what it is. The years at General Service were absolutely fantastic and exciting. See AA growing around the world. I had an opportunity to take a year off from the office, and I used it to travel around the world and visited AA in all faraway places. Fascinating to see how AA has grown in so many of these areas. And I like to tell the story about my first trip to Japan, because I was looking for the AA group. The office wanted me to check and see whether or not they should have given permission to translate a pamphlet into Japanese, because there was interest then in AA in Japan. Of course, now Japanese AA is full-blown. But at that time, it was mostly armed forces and people of that kind. Anyhow, I had to go to the meeting, and it was in St. Albans Church. So I took a cab from the hotel that I was in Tokyo, and they'd written out in Japanese for the taxi driver the address and also the hotel so that I could get back, because none of the drivers over there knew any English at that time. I guess they still don't. But anyhow, I got over there, and he dropped me off, and the Tokyo Tower was there, and it was pitch dark. It was November. It was 5:30 in the evening, and there was an old broken-down church standing there, and two little Japanese girls came out at that point. I tried to climb up some falling-down steps, and I couldn't seem to see anybody there, and so they came out, and so I yelled at them. You know, if you yell, they can understand better. They got was St. Albans Church, and so they pointed over to this building next door, which didn't look like a church. It was very modernistic, and that was St. Albans. So I went over there, and there was a library on the first floor, and there was a girl sitting in the library, and so I said to her, "Is there an AA group meeting here?" And she said, "Upstairs." So I went upstairs, and there was a hallway, and the head was at the end of the hall, and there were these doors. And this one said, "Third grade." And I listened, and I didn't hear anything. And the next one, I looked my ear up, and it said, "Second grade." And I still didn't hear anything. And the next one said, "First grade." And I put my ear up. I couldn't hear anything. And the next door said, "Kindergarten." And I put my ear to the door, and I heard, "Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path." And I thought, that's appropriate. That's where AA belongs, in the kindergarten. Because we're in kindergarten when we come here. The kindergarten of living. Because most of us have not known how to live until we got this program, until we had these steps to use, until we learned how to love and to share, and to learn the wonderful, wonderful way in which one can help another. And that's the great gift that we have, this ability to love, this ability to share, this ability to know that if we love, it's going to be returned, but not doing it for that reason. It's actually a celebration. A celebration, and a celebration of life, and a celebration of love. For God is love, and we do love each other. And I thank you.